Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show where we demonstrate that simply everything has its own history, like spinach, ladders and falling.
Or babies, rabies and scabies, Hades, ladies and gradees. That's all about the history of failure and exams. We'll be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Sam, who knew that the history of mountains is in fact all about freedom, prejudice, and the absence of history.
Ah.
Did you know that?
I did know that.
You did know that?
Yes.
We talk about that in our lovely book, Histories of the Unexpected, how everything has a history.
The man sitting opposite me is the nib of history itself. He is Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. It's James Daybell. Hello, James.
Hello, Sam. Hello, Sam. And the man sitting opposite me is the Basildon Bond of world history.
What a name.
See what I've done there? I've sort of made it sort of like exciting and spy-like, but combining it with stationery. It is the truly wonderful historical adventurer, Mr. History himself, Dr. Sam Willis.
Well, thanks for listening, everyone. We are today going to be talking about the history of writing. Now, it's a subject that we've touched on several of our previous podcasts. Is it not, James?
It certainly is.
We were talking about my writing slope I have just on your left there for our Boxes podcast.
You did, and you have another writing slope there. How can you have two writing slopes?
I don't know. This is my writing slope.
Oh. But that looks like a writing-y, slopey box thing.
Well, the one on your left is an actual box, and this one is my writing slope. So I haven't sort of got lost in my study.
We have talked a lot about the history of writing across the past few years. We've looked at the history of the pen, the history of the desk, the history of the study, the history of books. It's something that we are very much interested in.
Yeah, and we've done the signature. We talk about the signature.
We've done the signature
live show.
We've done paper.
Yeah, lots and lots of things. So it seems natural and appropriate for us to do the history of writing. Now, we did this because I was up in London doing some work in the British Library. I was doing some work on highwaymen, such is my life at the moment. Fascinating.
Very exciting.
Really good. We should do a separate one on highwaymen soon. And I went to the amazing writing Making Your Mark exhibition that was on at the British Library, and I got to interview Dr. Peter Toth, who is one of the people who was behind putting on one of the four co-curators of the exhibition. Managed to have a chat with him, and we are going to play the interview after we've had a bit of a chat about writing ourselves. So I've seen the exhibition, but you haven't. But you know a fair few things about writing.
Well, I've seen. I haven't actually been, but I've been on their website. I've seen the kinds of things that they're talking about, and it is absolutely fascinating. I mean, one of the things that struck me about it is the way in which it looks at the story of writing from the beginning.
Yeah.
And, you know, very often, a lot of the stuff that we've done has talked about writing in the modern Western world, I suppose. We sort of branch out a little bit. But by that, I take that Oxford University definition of modern history, which is anything that's not ancient. Mm. We've done a little bit of sort of ancient stuff. But it's tended to be the last 2,000 years. But what's striking about this is the global reach of it. and the way in which it goes right back to the sort of earliest forms. And I think one of the things that shocked me most about it, or interested me most about it, was the range of writing examples from, say, 2,000-3,000 years ago that were just about every day. You know, and it's people, it's a girl going to school. It is a, you know, it's somebody who hasn't been paid. Yeah. So they are communicating these very simple, ordinary, everyday things in writing.
I completely get that point, and I do agree with it totally. But the reason for being surprised, that's interesting, isn't it? Why are we surprised that people are doing this everyday stuff?
I think I think the thing that struck me is that when I study the rise of literacy in an English context, and you look at who is controlling the written word, it starts off with churchmen, and it is men, and then it goes into government, and it's driven by the state. Mm-hmm. And that what you don't find so much of is writing being used to communicate ordinary things outside of that. So it is really striking to capture that stuff much, much earlier.
So as a professional historian, that's definitely refreshing and lovely. But yes. I think that the general punter who's turned up at the exhibition would be as equally impressed by seeing something that's, you know, several centuries old, that's talking about them going shopping for some fish.
Absolutely.
There are two different answers, aren't there? There's the answer for the professional historian who knows that there's loads of writing associated with administration, associated with governments. Yeah. But then there's someone who's just interested in history, and they'll go along to the exhibition, but they still would go, oh, wow, they've gone to buy two loaves of bread.
Oh, yeah, which is great, because how do you access the ordinary life of an everyday person from 4,000 years ago? There was this one tweet from the British Library Medieval Manuscripts that I came across, which is a 4,000-year-old Babylonian clay tablet that's been loaned to the exhibition, and it says that it contains a list of cattle and donkeys ordered as gifts to a temple by somebody named Baa. Bought by a sheep.
The variety of things. What really struck me most was that you have so many different ways that you can study writing, but the exhibition has managed to encompass so many of them. It hasn't just gone down the ancient shopping route. Gone down the government administration route or the material culture of writing. It's kind of done them all, which is what really appealed to me, because it's what we do basically on our podcast. It's exploding a subject and saying, actually, you can look at it this way, you can look at it that way, you can look at it all sorts of these variety of ways. So I was hugely reassured, actually, that they were doing something that I think made the most out of the material they had.
Yes.
Whereas every single thing in that exhibition is completely amazing, and you can make an exhibition on the theme, almost whatever it is, but they've managed to get them all together and nothing is lost by doing that.
Brilliant. Should we listen to the interview?
Let's listen to the interview.
Okay. Do you want to introduce it?
This is me in London talking to Dr. Peter Toth, the co-curator of the Writing Making Your Mark exhibition that's on currently at the British Library.
Hello, everyone. Well, I'm delighted to be in the British Library, and I've just been to see their new exhibition on the history of writing, which is full of wonderful, unexpected subjects. And I'm here with someone who's going to tell us all about it. Peter, will you introduce yourself for me?
Hello, it's very nice to meet you. I'm Peter Toth, curator of ancient and medieval manuscripts here at the British Library. And I'm also one of the four curators who organised, curated and looked after this exhibition, which we have open now, Writing, Making Your Mark.
Writing, Making Your Mark. It was wonderful. I love the fact that there was a team behind it. I wasn't expecting that. Does that mean there were some good arguments about what went in?
It is, because it was unexpected even for the library how diverse the subject of writing is.
Sure.
So we wanted to explore it from various angles and also in a global context, for which we had to have a team who is and who has expertise on various aspects, especially the Asian and African languages and writing systems, to which I have no clue, I have to confess that.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had two people, myself and another one, who was the lead curator, Adrian Edwards, who looked after the Western side of things, so the Roman alphabet, the print in Europe and in the States, and the other two looked into an amazing array of writing systems and histories.
Yeah.
And this is how we put together this exhibition, to be so global, so diverse and so big.
Yeah, it's lovely to see historians all working together to produce something so magical, actually. One of the things, James and I, both with our podcast, we've talked about writing, we've talked about pens a lot, we've talked about books and printing a lot, because it's a wonderful starting point to open up all sorts of different subjects, which is what you do so magnificently in the exhibition. What's your favourite bit?
It's hard to say, you see, because it varies. So my favourite bit at the beginning was to find the oldest object in the library, because we have been told, and we have been saying, that the oldest thing in the library, unexpectedly, is not a book, nothing written on parchment or paper, but a piece of bone, the Chinese oracle bones.
Yes, yeah.
Which are thought to have come from about 1300 BC.
Yeah.
And unexpectedly, another thing unexpected, we found in the papers of a pioneering British photographer from the early 19th century a piece of stone carved with Egyptian hieroglyphs in the boxes of his papers, which came to the library quite recently as a donation from the family, a carved piece of stone on limestone filled with hieroglyphs. So we had to ask expert advice from the British Museum to date it and to read it, and it turned out to be much older than the Chinese oracle bones. So that's the oldest object currently on display in the exhibition, which is more than 3,500 years old, predating a couple of centuries, the oracle bones.
Yeah, it's such a lovely sense of the library being alive, your collections continually growing, you guys continually discovering stuff. It's not like you've got a solid single collection which remains the same and people are constantly going back to it. Everything's alive and dynamic about it, which is what you get a real sense of in the exhibition as well. And you can, now I know there were four people involved, I can see how it all happened. I liked so many different aspects of it. I thought the Chinese typewriter was so from the early 20th century. That's a seriously amazing invention. I've got no idea how it would work. And even if you left me in a room with that for a year, I wouldn't be able to make it work.
Which have been the case with for the Chinese as well, because there was a manual published next to the typewriter itself, which told you how to use it, because its use and function is very different from the ordinary typewriters, as you may have seen it in the label.
Yeah.
So you need to know all the 2,500 characters in Chinese, which are set up on the tray, and then you had to find the right one which you wanted to use with this little kit, and then lift it up and press it against the paper. And this is how you had to find every single piece on the tray and put them to the paper and to type the text, which must have been a very time-consuming kind of experiment, but it wasn't if you got used to it.
What I liked about it is I was trying to think of what different aspects of writing really appealed to me, and I wanted to be able to say, well, writing for me is all about whatever it might be. And I think, for me, it was all about art, which we want to talk about in a minute, being able to use writing to express yourself and create something beautiful. Mm-hmm. But it's also about speed. Mm. It's about saving time. Mm. I was always told off at school because I wrote too quickly. Oh. And I constantly didn't tell my teachers, but they were missing the point. If I didn't get all of my ideas down, then I was missing some of my ideas. Mm. Would they not be happier to have something slightly scribbled, but have all of my ideas out? Mm. Apparently not, which I still maintain is the wrong answer. Mm. Now, if you look at all of the different things here, the James Joyce's, his crazy notes, when he sort of vomits out words, that really appealed to me.
Good expression, actually.
And the wonderful thing about, it's a form of Arabic, which is designed so that you take your nib off the page as few times as possible to speed up your writing. So that those things kind of combined with the typewriter, I really liked.
Because these were the two driving forces in the evolution of writing, to write as fast as possible, as much as possible in a relatively short amount of time. But on the other side, there was always this demand to make it beautiful, to make it artistic, to make it very clear. Sometimes it's this beauty was actually damaging the clarity of writing. So there was another aspect, and that was clarity and the fact that it is recognizable as writing and text. And these three aspects or topics were fighting and, you know, against each other. Sometimes it was beauty actually overshadowing clarity and speed. Sometimes it was speed when shorthand was invented, for example. Hardly any people could read that way, but it was very fast and efficient. Yeah. And then was clarity, which again damaged and overshadowed the other two. And these three were competing throughout the history of the evolution of writing.
Mm. That's beautifully explained. Can you write in shorthand?
I can't. No. My mom can.
Can you? Yeah. Would you like that? I've always wanted to be able to. My wife can, but I can't.
So I was actually surprised, how unexpected, that a lot of people can still use it, and they actually use it in taking minutes and meetings. Yeah. So I would really love to know how it works. And there was an interesting, funny reference to shorthand in Count Dracula by Bram Stoker, because Jonathan Harker keeps his records and diaries in shorthand, and the Count wants to see it. And he takes it as an insult that he cannot read shorthand. And he destroys all the diaries.
Okay. I mean, shorthand, it's something I'd like to be able to do just because it's a nice skill to have. But it kind of defeats the object for writing for me, because I'm lucky in that if I write something down, I'll probably remember it. Mm. And shorthand's all about you being able to read what you've already written. Whereas for me, the priority with writing is communication to another person.
That's true.
I think it would depend. I suppose the point is it's so personal, the exhibition. So you talked about the oracle bones. What was the purpose of that writing?
That was about getting divine advice, yeah, and answers to your intriguing questions.
So we have lots of very ancient examples, yes, of handwriting that moves up through printing presses, and then we've got all the sort of wonderful things from the 20th century. And I think what's so fabulous about it is that if you go to the exhibition, everyone will find something different within it which will appeal to them. It will make them think differently about not only their handwriting, but why they write in the way they do and why they're interested in that particular aspect of it. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And that was one of the... I'm very glad that this message went through, yeah, because that was one of the main drivers of this exhibition, to make people think about not just the history of writing, which was basically on the second place. We wanted to use the history of writing to make people think about their own handwriting and their own engagement with this remarkable tool. Which is like magic, right? Which you can turn your words, the language and thoughts, even the unspoken word, into something visual.
What I also love about it is the... So you're seeing lots of examples of someone's handwriting at a snapshot in time, okay? But people's handwriting also changes over time. Mm-hmm. So your handwriting now will be different to your handwriting when you were a younger man, when you were a teenager, when you were a child. And that's always fascinated me. But even at one particular time in your life, you can write in different ways. So I could write... I'm very interested in handwriting, but I can write in three or four different ways right now, and it depends who I'm writing to on how I write. And my daughter was doing some homework the other day, and she could flit immediately between proper handwriting and... I want to finish this as quickly as possible, handwriting, so I can go upstairs. And I love that as well, the sense of a personal history in people's writing.
Yes, that's present in the exhibition. And also you can wonder about how various types of writing were used at the same time for various purposes. For example, the star item, Lindisfarne Gospels, you can see more or less, there is a 200 years difference between the main text in Latin, the Gospels, and the English translation of the same text between the lines. There is a 200 years difference, but the writing used for English is so much different from Latin. Mm. And people just somehow had that feeling that if you write in your native tongue, that should be written somehow differently. It doesn't mean anything about the dignity or the rank of that writing. It should be different. And that is something you can see all over the Middle Ages in Europe and everywhere else, that the vernacular, the particular language of the area was written in a different way than the Latin, the official, the nice, the liturgical, the holy language was written.
So there's a sort of history of authority and breaking the rules and being slightly subversive there as well. I also like the idea of letters themselves telling you something about the society. The great example from the Russian Revolution, where they believed that...
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The way that they formed their letters would say as much about the actual words that they were writing.
That's very true. And this is why, actually, this is such a common thing that governments sometimes want to change this, because they are aware of this additional message behind the letters. So we have an example of this from China, the simplified Chinese, which was part of the Cultural Revolution. So they wanted to change the past, and especially people's relationship to the past. So they abolished certain letters and characters from Chinese, so that this reference to past things like religion or cultural heritage disappears. And a new language, a new society, a new culture appears, and that was present in the Russian Revolution as well, when the old Russian Cyrillic characters were actually deleted from the alphabet, because they had references to the cross, they had references to old Church Slavonic, and they deleted them, and a new language appeared.
So you've got to be able to see the gaps in what you're looking at, as well as actually read the document themselves. It's a fundamental point for all historians to learn, which is why I think the exhibition is so important. I also love the fact that when you think about writing, and someone says, okay, what about inventions associated with writing? Oh, you go, printing press, or the stylus, or the nib. But the one message you get from this exhibition is that writing itself is an invention. It didn't just happen, it was invented. It is something that our brains have created and then practiced. I absolutely love that. That really stopped me short, thinking about it as an invention.
And that's, again, a very historical concept, because people always tried to figure out who is the inventor of writing. So they always tried to imagine a particular figure with a name who invented writing. So sometimes it's Thoth, the god of wisdom in Egyptian. He was credited with the invention of writing. For the Hindi tradition, there is another god behind writing, and it's surprisingly, unexpectedly, the Roman alphabet was credited with a woman who is called Carmenta, who was a semi-goddess in Italy, and she was believed to invent the Roman alphabet. So the idea of invention is pretty much present in the tradition and the historical tradition and the legendary tradition about writing, although scholarship highly debates this idea. So we can't name an individual inventor of writing. And it may not be an invention like printing press is. It's not a sudden kind of, a phenomenon which starts from nothing out of blue. It has a very, very long history. And there is no genius who invented it. It's us, people, who invented it. And this is why, because this is a common story of all of us.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's a collective thing, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think back through the exhibition now to see that some of the other favourite things. I love that, talking about it being an invention, it's also, it's learnt behaviour. Mm-hmm. So if someone can write, then there's the shadow of the person who's taught them to write. Mm-hmm. And there's like a shadow chain of people going back through history. But all you've got is this moment when it manifests itself in some form. What I'd really like, what's the clay tablet that's right at the beginning with the curious sort of scratch marks in it? What was that?
That is a cuneiform tablet, which is actually the tiniest, smallest thing in the entire exhibition, next to the largest one we have. And that is a representation, an example of the earliest writing system of the word, cuneiform, which started with something which is hardly writing at all, which is the oldest item in the exhibition from the same area, pretty much from the same period, from about 5,000 years ago. And that's the proto-cuneiform, a pre-cuneiform sign, which is half writing, because it's just images of things, and then particular a complicated signage system for numbers.
Yeah.
And this is how writing started. And this is why we think that cuneiform writing is probably the oldest writing system in the world.
I love to imagine, if you think of the layers of history of people working with this kind of writing, I love to imagine the moment where a historian or an archaeologist realised that it was writing and not a pattern.
Yes.
And that they were actually trying to communicate something.
And that must have been a great moment of invention. So in that sense, invention and the idea of invention is present in the history of writing and the discussion about writing. Just if we think about the great movement of the decipherment of the Egyptian language in 1822, more or less 200 years ago, which was by the French scholar Champollion, who used the Rosetta Stone, as you know, which has... three kinds of writing systems in two languages, and he used the Greek translation of the Egyptian texts to decipher the Egyptian writing system on the basis of names, because he supposed that names should be more or less similar in all of these languages and writing systems. So he did know where the names are in the Greek texts, and he tried to find out actually on the basis of the size of the text and the numbers of lines, where those names could be in the Egyptian text, and tried to figure out how he could read the names in the hieroglyphs. And he was the first who discovered that names in ancient Egyptian are put in a circle, which we all know now as the cartouche, which is for the royal names. And this is how he started to decipher the royal names and the hieroglyphs behind it. And he was quite unlucky because he started with a very late stage of the hieroglyphs from the 2nd century BC, which is a complicated system of the hieroglyphs. Because at the later you go, the more complicated it gets. And poor Champollion had to work on a very complicated signage system of ancient Egyptian. Yeah. Well, he managed.
But you see the kind of the layers of what's going on here. So you've got the people who've invented it, you've got the people who've taught them how to do it. And with these examples, whether it's the Rosetta Stone or that small cuneiform tablet, you've got a person trying to communicate something either to themselves for later recall or to someone else. And there's a fabulous example where you could take this idea of all of these individual people and you think about people as a group. It's collective writing, where there's a group of people in Bangladesh have signed a petition against the division of Bangladesh and India in 1905. And that was so powerful, this collection of individuals all writing in a book. Mm-hmm. And I love the sense of that as well, the idea that you can have one person writing or a whole group of people.
Yes, that shows the power of writing, doesn't it? From up to down and from down to the higher levels of society. And that is a particularly strong piece, actually, which contains 60,000 signatures of everyday people recording their names and addresses.
Yeah, it's slightly frustrating. I mean, just because of the problems of display, you can only display one page, but you want to flick through it and see who all these people were, don't you?
Which is why we digitise this content. So it will be digitised, it will be published online on the library's digitised manuscripts page, where you can actually turn the pages and see all 65,000 signatures.
Wow. I'd actually love to do that. I'd spend hours. You'd see every individual person, their own choice of handwriting. They're all signing a significant document. You can measure literacy as well, as, you know, that's how people have used handwriting
and
scholars have.
You can see how the multilingualism works in one particular document, because people sign their names in English, some of them in the local script, in Indian and Hindi. So you can see how multilingual the area was and how powerful writing can be, even if you may not be able to read it.
That's very true. And I think we should end it there. Just a thought about how powerful writing can be. It's an amazing exhibition. I thoroughly enjoyed myself. It's Writing, Make Your Mark, and it's on at the British Library. Thank you very much indeed, Peter.
Thank you very much for coming and seeing me.
So that was my very enjoyable interview with Dr. Peter Toth. James, were there any bits there you were particularly jealous of not having seen in person?
Most of it. And having met the curator himself, who sounds enormously knowledgeable. I mean, one of the things that I think is most striking about it is the fact that it has been put together by four different curators. And I thought the interesting point there is that in order to really get to grips with the complexity of this material, in that you're dealing with different time periods, different scripts, different kinds of language, that you actually need four world experts So you need people who can do, you know, who can do Africa, or people who can do ancient civilizations. And that, I thought, was really, you know, really impressive. What was your favorite bit in the exhibition?
There was a little bit about typefaces in the Russian Revolution.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
There's a cultural history of typefaces, which I didn't know anything about. So this is after the revolution, and the revolutionaries decide that the actual design of the lettering they're going to use is going to say as much about their ideas and beliefs as the actual words that they get across, which is what it was profound and very interesting. And I've since come across all sorts of other examples, which I didn't know about, of cultural history relating to the way things are written. One of them could have easily gone in our World War II book.
What's that? I mean, not what's the World War II book. We know what that is, but what example?
It was the Nazis and how they decided that they basically changed the typefaces they used. There's a black letter one. It was called the black letter typeface. So in 1941, there's an agreement made between Hitler and the publishers of a German nationalist newspaper, and they decide to abandon this black letter font and adopt one which is a much more regular. So the black letter is like the kind of heavily Gothic script, yes, that you might see,
yes,
which had been lost throughout a lot of Europe after the Napoleonic Wars, but it stayed in Germany, and they decided it was too associated with things they weren't happy with. They actually rebranded it as Jewish writing, Jewish letters, and it wasn't allowed to be used anymore. So the Nazis officially adopted a font. And you can do this kind of cultural history of typefaces and fonts right across time.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'd love to know more about that. I know here we are. Charlemagne had a particular typeface associated with him, the Roman de Roi. Was commissioned by Louis XIV. Bonaparte, Napoleon, good old Bonaparte, he had his own typeface. Peter the Great, too. It's something you can follow right through history.
Yeah. And always, I mean, with Charlemagne, this is pre-type, but you're talking about a particular sort of Carolinian script, yep, like Carolinian minuscule. I think there's actually quite a lot of work that's been done on this by typographers and the meaning of different kinds of typography. And that black letter script is really interesting because it has a history that's much earlier. It's one of the first forms of typeface that children would have learnt to use, learnt to read. So you learn to read with that. And where throughout the 16th and 17th and into the 18th century, where there are particular passages that you want to emphasise and you want everyone to be able to read, you render them in that particular typeface. And we talked the other day when we looked at Pirates, and we looked at the book that you're publishing, The Notorious Murderous Pirates, and we looked at how Anne Bonny and her sort of female pirate counterpart were being used to advertise the book. Their names appeared in a different font, a different typeface from other people. One of the sort of big questions, I suppose, that the exhibition begs is this question of why did writing come into being? Why was it invented early on? And also another big question is you know, what kinds of activities has writing facilitated and developed over time? You know, writing is a technology. And famously, people have argued that it has restructured the way in which people think, that it has enabled people to operate in different ways. Historians or anthropologists who are interested in pre-literate cultures, oral cultures, have argued that we shouldn't overemphasize that. But, you know, did you get a sense wandering around the exhibition of why writing was useful? Why did people sort of invent it?
Yes, and there are so many different answers to that question, which is what I think was yep, great. I think the idea of expressing opinions either by writing an entire book or simply by approving something by putting your signature to it.
Yes.
That was very powerful.
Yes.
So you know, your opinion as a person is equally as valid with your name.
Yeah.
As it is writing a 100,000 word
book. It's also linked to very simple impulses and activities early on, you know, that can be as simple as counting. You know, as simple as literally counting. One of the most interesting things that I came across was a 4,000-year-old tablet that records workers' wages. And this is from Mesopotamia. And, you know, it's absolutely extraordinary that something like that was used in a very practical sense. Some of the other things that it's connected with are, you know, this kind of being able to name things. So the signature, for want of another sort of phrase, putting your name on something to identify that it is actually yours. Yeah. It's your property, it's your coinage, it's your whatever. If you are seeking to impose ownership over something, you want to put your name on it, whether that be ownership through some kind of legal document, law, code that you're putting through, whether it be something on a building that shows that it's yours, whether it be something on coinage, you know, the written word, your name. And we've looked at this when we wrote the book on Romans, that how important those kinds of inscriptions were. Also, thinking about people dying and wanting to memorialise people, which is a very basic human desire to want to be able to commemorate and memorialise. And so some of the earliest writing that survives to us is on, as you know, on gravestones. It's on inscriptions or funerary monuments, which have a, you know, long and ancient history.
The other bit I really liked about it was the physical side to it, that writing is something that you have to be taught, that you have to practice. There's a repetitive element to it. So there's an entire world and history of exercise books and textbooks where people have to learn to write in, yes, a certain way. And whoever's deciding how you learn to write and has decided there's an official way of writing. And if there's an official way, there's always an unofficial way. And that makes it fascinating. So I love the way that the official kind of exercise books almost tee you up to break the rules,
yes,
basically.
Yes.
You know, and if you try and get me to write within lines, then I simply won't do it. And I love that.
That does not surprise me.
There are also wonderful ways of
subversive Sam
of how to hold your pen and how that's changed.
Right.
And there's the whole history of which hand you write with. So I'm right-handed. I'm very fortunate. I was not left-handed and born in the Victorian period, because they were all forced to write right-handed. And there were special techniques invented by Victorian writing masters to train people out of their left-handedness. And there's a whole history of left-handedness, which I think is really interesting. Da Vinci was left-handed.
But if my 7-year-old is left-handed.
All of that with his left hand is extraordinary, says a right-handed man.
Brilliant, brilliant. I mean, the other thing that I think came across in the exhibition is that they bring it up to the contemporary, to today. So, you know, you go from Egyptian hieroglyphs all the way up to emojis. And one of the things that we're so used to today is, you know, working with digital devices, whether it be smartphones and texts, whether it be computers and email, whether it be coding, whether it be tablets. And there is a sense in which some people think that there will be no use for handwriting in the future. Was that something that they dealt with at all?
Yes, there's a big bit at the end about where is handwriting going.
Yeah.
And one of the most reassuring things is they had a large piece of paper at the end of the exhibition where people were scribbling their own thoughts, and some people just put their names, other people did some doodles. And it's such a kind of human thing to leave your mark, to make your mark at the end of it.
Yeah.
Which I loved that. I thought that was really good. And no, it's much more reassuring than not. It's not frightening, as I suspect it could have been. They could have teed it up that way.
But there was, I think
I think you leave with more pride in your ability to write than,
yeah,
and more interest in how you write and what you're writing than that you have when you arrived, which is the key point.
Yeah, there was a very interesting piece that I read on their blog by somebody who was a psychologist, and one of the things, a child psychologist, and one of the things that she was doing there was talking about the usefulness of handwriting for being taught to children. And she says that in a survey in the US in 2012, they looked at the importance of handwriting. Some of the facts that they came out, some of the sort of analysis that came out of it, was that it actually enhanced fact recall and composition quality because you were learning to write. And also, when you're taught at that very early age to form letters, that's something that enhances your ability to be able to read. So actually being forced to do something yourself, it also helps with critical thinking and language and the recall of concepts. And I think there's something about writing that is connected to cognition. I mean, maybe it's because we've been so used to, you know, handwriting for so many years that we think in those ways, and new ways will evolve around, you know, a sort of a keyboard and screen. But I think there is something in the importance of writing, in that it, I find it a really, when I start thinking about things afresh, I instinctively turn to a pad and paper.
Yeah, me too.
When I plan my time, when I sit down and plan my week or my year or whatever, it's always on paper. And I think increasingly in this world of well-being, where we're supposed to be sort of so sensitive to our mental health and mental state, I think actually slowing down a little bit, going digitally dark and writing on paper is something that actually is fundamentally good for us. There's quite a lot of research done. You can buy those well-being diaries. You know, the ones where at the end of the day you're supposed to sit down and record certain things that have gone well that day as a way of sort of grounding you and making you more appreciative of, you know, the life that we all lead. So, see, handwriting is a very powerful thing.
I think it anchors things in time, doesn't it?
Yes.
Literally anchors, for me. If I sit down and I write something, it gets stuck in my head. It's usually chaotic and frenetic and scribbly, but it kind of happened.
Yes.
And if it's happened, it means I'm going to do something about it.
Yes.
And I won't forget it.
Yes.
And that simply doesn't happen if I do it on my phone or on a computer. No.
And I wonder whether also it enhances creativity. When the wonderful Daniel Jameson, the playwright that we've been working with and friend of ours, sat down and put together the plan for his ideas, framework for the live show of Histories of the Unexpected. If you have a look at that A3 sheet he did, it is full of doodles and scribbles and lines going from here to there, joining everything up.
Yeah, well, I think we basically said you can do the history of anything you want in the whole history of time, connected anywhere you want it to be connected. Off you go.
he reduced it to an A3 sheet.
Yeah.
Genius.
Anchoring things in time, I think that's important. And it's certainly if I have to remember anything.
Brilliant.
That's how I use it.
So if people want to see this exhibition, where should they go? This Making the Mark exhibition
at the British Library.
And it's open, I think, for several more months. It's open until August.
It's truly brilliant. I loved it, and it's changed the way that I think about all sorts of things. So well done, the team at the British Library, and thank you very much, Peter Toth, for your time in talking to us. Thanks for listening, everyone. If you've enjoyed it, please let us know. Please leave us a review on iTunes. It really, really matters. It helps us keep the mics on and keeping everything going. You can follow me at Dr. Sam Willis on Twitter.
And you can follow me on Twitter at James Daybell. And you can follow Histories of the Unexpected on at Unexpected Pod.
Now, for everything we've got coming up, stuff on our books, stuff on our live shows, we've got tons of live shows coming up, and it's the thing that James and I enjoy more than anything else, apart from our podcast and writing the books.
and our day job.
You can find this all out at historiesoftheunexpected.com. Do please get in touch. Thank you so much for listening, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.